And welcome back to Fully Equipped, Golf.com's gear-focused podcast, where we take tour news and relate it to golfers of all skill levels. This is Tim Brion, Senior Vice President of TruSpec Golf, joined by Jonathan Wall, Managing Equipment Editor for Golf.com. Jonathan, what's up, bud?
What's up, Professor? I'm laid up. You know, it's been 7 years since I...
Too much grinding.
It's been 7 years since I've been sick. People are going to call BS on that, but I've got a really incredible immune system. And, you know, I felt like I was kind of coming down with something before, but 24 hours later, I'm usually feeling good. And went to bed last night and woke up this morning and still feeling crummy. So I'm hoping with, you know, like you, I've got a big travel week after Turkey Day. So I hope this doesn't linger for too long. But yeah, I'm laid up here in bed with a sweatshirt and the hood on. All I'm missing is the sunglasses, and I could probably pass for the Unabomber.
Nice. So Ted Kaczynski on the podcast, everybody. No, just kidding around. Sorry to hear you're under the weather, man. Yeah, I'm actually back here in Scottsdale. I think you're at home. So for once, we get to record one of these from our home base locations. But next week, we will both be on the road. I know you're heading out to San Diego, spend some time with our folks at TaylorMade. And I'll be on my way to New York and then back to Pinehurst. Good news is you and I get to sync up for a little bit next week, so that should be some fun.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking about everybody's favorite topic, club test. So looking forward to kind of...
That's right, kind of putting the last wheels in motion to get that thing off the ground and, you know, settle out some of the content that we were able to uncover through player and robotic testing. So that should be a lot of fun. So nice episode for all you listeners out there today. A couple of tour topics as usual. We noticed Ricky with some new irons in the bag. Also, John Rahm put some new wedges in play. Obviously, that ended up being fairly successful. We've got SM8 out on tour, Titleist Vokey wedge line, spin milled 8, so we'll talk a little bit about that. Got a couple of questions from social media for the mailbag segment for today, and then we'll get into part 2 of our David Orr interview. So, should be a great episode, but to start off here, what do you got for us on Ricky's irons, Jonathan?
Yeah, you know, thanks to the Floridians social media account, I can't believe that I'm giving them a hat tip here. That they're stealing my thunder, I feel like a little bit, but they posted a photo from the Floridian pro member, and this was an opportunity for not only Ricky but DJ to kind of knock the rust off Ricky's. You know, he had a virus. He was supposed to play Mayakoba, and then before that, he was on his honeymoon and also got married. So he hasn't played since the Tour Championship, and you know, he shows up to the Floridian pro member, and he's got new Cobra prototype blades in the bag. I know everybody's favorite word, prototype, only because this isn't out at retail yet. So that's how we're gonna categorize it right now. But being the gear nerd that I am, I zoomed in and found a very grainy picture of these irons with you. I mean, you could see the word Cobra on them, Tim. But other than that, all we really knew was they were just muscle back blades. The one difference that I did pick up on was Ricky's gone from the dark finish that he had on his recent King MB irons. You know, he told me about a year ago that he liked that darker finish because it visually just makes the head look a little bit more compact. And he's now back to what looks to be a satin finish. Some new pictures have come out, and I posted them on my Twitter account at Jonathan R. Wall. A guy by the name of I think it's Mully Golf was the one who I don't know where he ended up getting these photos from, but posted a couple of them, close-ups of these new, they're called the RF. It's got RF on the toe. So maybe Ricky's getting his own irons, Tim, but yeah, it looks like Rick's gonna be bagging some new irons here pretty soon. And the timing of it's pretty interesting with it coming right against the President's Cup coming up that he's now a member of Team USA.
Be very interested to see if these irons stay in play through the President's Cup. You know, the tour doesn't really have an off season these days.
God, I wish they did.
The wraparound schedule. you know, it's tough for them to start testing new prototype products because they end up playing in events that actually matter. So they're having to take unbattle tested product into, you know, events that they would prefer not to. So, but I'd be shocked if we see the irons in play over the President's Cup, just because we know that this is something that's important to Ricky And he's going to want to make sure that his performance is as optimized as could be.
I don't know.
I think he'll have him in play.
I think you might see him. You know, obviously, I think the litmus test here is, are they going to be in the bag at Hero? Because I know he's playing Tiger's event right before he heads to Australia. So, you know, if they're in the bag there, I would say there's probably a pretty good chance, unless he just plays really poorly. I think he probably puts him in play. You know, we've talked about this in the past. There's not a ton you can do with a muscle back blade. You know, most really good players don't want you to manipulate the profile or even the CG location all that much. And Ricky's irons are not your typical muscle back blades because he I'd probably say maybe like 4 or 5 years ago when he went to shorter length irons, he put a tungsten slug in the toe and a tungsten slug in the sole of his irons. And one of the reasons why he did this was because of going to that shorter length. He wanted to weight up the heads, but he actually found that by adding more mass with that tungsten, it gave him a more solid, heavy feel. And based on some of the photos that have now come out of these new RF prototype irons, you can see the hole where they're going to be able to put that tungsten slug into the toe. So it looks like Ricky's going to be continuing with this tungsten design in these muscle back irons. It's actually, in my opinion, Tim, it's got if you recall the Cobra, the Amp Pro irons, you know, Ricky used a set of those. And
a lot of similarities there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, these to me have the Amp Pro profile. And again, those Amp Pros were also a satin finish. So maybe there's a little bit something to that. I'm kind of curious why he's going away from the dark finish and going back to of a more traditional look. But bottom line, looks like he's testing something new. The irons look great, and they've got a really clean look. And I'm sure there are some better players out there that are probably drooling all over these irons, hoping that they make their way to retail.
Yeah, so muscle back blades, as you mentioned, there's not a lot that can be done. Sometimes you can displace some of the weight from the middle of that muscle back and get it down into the sole. When you look at some products that exist out there, you'll see these, you know, subtle design elements in the back of the golf club where clearly they're removing weight from the center, and they're not necessarily perimeter weighting the product, but they are displacing some of that weight a little bit, you know, towards the sole to get the sole thicker. You mentioned the tungsten slugs and the shorter length. You know, that's something that initially is done for swing weighting.
Right.
So when you build a golf club, you know, anything that's shorter than what the designer club maker intended that club to be played at as far as length, you know, when they're designing a club head around a specific concept that this product is going to be played at 37.5 inches on a 6-iron, they're going to engineer the 6-iron head to come out somewhere around 262 grams. And then those gram weights in those heads will correspond to the length of shaft that's intended to be installed in that product at standard length. So if you end up building a set of clubs that's a little different than that standard length, specifically shorter, you're going to have to add more weighting into the club head to offset that weight that's not present because of the shorter shaft. And that's in order to keep swing weighting up to a certain, you know, a certain measurement that's acceptable for the player. So now when you add that weight, it's funny how many players I see with lead tape on their golf clubs. They have no idea.
I was about to say they have no clue. I shouldn't say that. I don't want to discount the guys that do, but I would say that
the vast majority,
70% probably have no idea. They've probably seen Tiger or some tour pro do it. And that's kind of, it's like, hey, well, if they're doing it, then I should do it. And they probably have it in the wrong location. They're probably using either, most of the time, I'd say probably too much lead tape. But yeah, I agree with you. Most probably have no idea what they're doing.
Have you ever used lead tape on any of your golf clubs?
Just the putter. But again, it was kind of one of those things where I saw tour pros using it and I was an impressionable, you know, 12, 13 year old. I'll totally cop to that. But you know, it's like you see the tour pros using it, you want to do it too. And I had lead tape on in the cavity of my, and here's the funny part. I used lead tape in the cavity of a Scotty Cameron Torellium with those little white dots. I don't know how I didn't destroy the back cavity of that putter because I left the lead tape in there for a really long time until it fell off. But yeah, I mean, I just threw it in there. I thought it looked cool, and it was kind of gave me a tour vibe. So yeah, but I had no idea what I was doing.
I'll always remember back to a player that I fit where I looked in the back cavity of one of the wedges that he had, in the pitching wedge specifically, the wedge that was part of the iron set. And lo and behold, I look back there, I see some tape. I look a little closer. He didn't put lead tape in there. He put duct tape back there.
That will not work. That is not what you're supposed to be doing,
yeah,
sir.
That's not what you're supposed to use. But suffice to say, where you put that weight when you're using lead tape can have an enormous impact over some of the inertial characteristics of the club. You know, when you're talking about drivers and using lead tape, you know, whether you're putting it low or high, way out on the toe, way in on the heel, you're not actually moving CG that far. That's the thing, is when you start using lead tape or hot melt, you're not moving CG very far, only a couple of millimeters in the extreme cases. But the thing to remember is that it has a compound effect over performance. And even though the CG is only changing a few millimeters, you'll end up seeing ball flight differences that are significant downrange. So to all those folks out there that say that adjustable weighting only moves the CG a couple of millimeters and so therefore it's ineffective, the first part of that statement is right, that it only moves it a couple of millimeters. But testing actually says you don't need to move it very far to change how a club performs pretty radically. When you're talking about this tungsten slug, you mentioned that there's a tungsten slug that's added into the toe as well as into the sole of the club. That's going to add a little bit of stability, as well as it's also going to cause a little bit higher launch, you know, specifically. And then when you're talking about the weighting out on the toe, that's going to move some of the CG properties more towards the toe.
Yep.
So in other words, the sweet spot tends to move a little bit more toeward. Whenever you're looking at muscle back blades in general, the sweet spot or the hardest part of the face with a lot of these products tends to be just a fraction heel biased. Well, if you're somebody that tends to strike it a hair more out on the toe, and if you're playing shorter than standard length irons, it would stand to reason that you would strike it out there. You know, maybe having a little bit more mass out on the toe is a good thing because it's moving the sweet spot just a hair more towards the toe side, which is where that player's striking it. So really, really excited to see what these products look like. As with most muscle back blades, this is clearly not a play by Cobra to try to, produce an iron that's going to be used for the masses. I think a lot of OEMs will admit that they end up giving away more sets of muscle back blades than they end up selling at the end of a product life cycle. So this is clearly something they're designing with Ricky's input, specifically for Ricky, hoping that they can also use this with some of their other tour staff. But as we mentioned in last week's episode, as well as many episodes before this, you know, Cobra is doing a great job at their product line in general. All of their different iron, fairway, hybrid, driver, head products have really performed exceptionally well over the last few years. And this is the first muscle back blade we've seen out of Cobra in a couple years, if I'm not mistaken. And with that, I think we can get into our second tour topic for the week, which has to do with Jon Rahm. You know, kind of an interesting side note here. I still have quite a few folks that work with the team back at TaylorMade. And Rombo is kind of unique in that every time he pays a visit to the Kingdom, which is TaylorMade's fitting facility in San Diego, every time he's out there, he seems to get a W on the board shortly after the trip. But this trip ended up yielding an interesting makeup on his wedges. What's going on with Rombo's wedges, Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, he should probably make more trips out there if he's gonna come home with $5 million in the bank account like he did after winning the European Tour's race to Dubai. He, as you mentioned, made another trip out to the Kingdom and just happened to find a new TaylorMade milled grind lob wedge. And you're probably thinking, all right, lob wedge, who really cares? Well, this one is a little bit different than just your standard milled grind to lob wedge because the grind on this is stamped TW11. Now, there's only one guy on TaylorMade staff with the initials TW. That would be Big Cat himself. And, you know, Tiger being Tiger, of course he's going to get his own wedge grind. I would argue that the Tiger probably has one of the most complex wedge grinds on the entire tour. And the funny thing is that he only plays, aside from the pitching wedge, he only plays a two-wedge setup, 56 and a 60. He's pretty traditional. But Rahm had a chance to pick up Tiger's grind on this lob wedge and loved it, so much so that he ended up taking it with him to Dubai, throws it in the bag, and ends up winning. Now, obviously, the lob wedge isn't the only reason that he wins, but it's still a really cool story. I actually reached out to TaylorMade and found out that other than Tiger, Rahm's the only one who is playing Tiger's grind. And, you know, people might be surprised, you know, now with TaylorMade's able to do with the CNC milling process, you know, what took the guys that used to work on his wedges in the past countless hours to just build him. You know, this is a funny story I'll tell. Tiger told me back earlier this year in Austin that when Mike Taylor was working on his wedges, he would build Tiger eight wedges. So he would have four sets of wedges. Yep. And he would go through those eight wedges, and when he was done with them, he'd have the grooves reblasted, and he'd use them one more go-around. And after that point, they'd start the process all over again. Now, the CNC milling process is able to bang out Tiger's wedges with his specific grind, no issues whatsoever, in a matter of minutes. Whereas Mike Taylor was working long, hard hours to try and get these wedges absolutely perfect. Now, I'm sure Mike T., being the wedge master that he is, you know, after a while he probably could have done these with his eyes closed. But still, it just goes to show you what the CNC milling process can do, especially when it comes to something as specific as Tiger's grind. And he just, you know, for people wondering what's so different about Tiger's wedges, a few years ago I actually found out that he really wants wedges, not just the 60, but a 56, that are able to hit a variety of shots. So Tiger's wedge, if you want some specifics here, his lob wedge is designed for extreme flop shots. It has 34 degrees of bounce in the leading edge. The overall bounce on this wedge is 11 degrees, but because it has a shaved heel, it has a measured bounce of 4 degrees, which if he opens up that face, Tim, and you know this, with 4 degrees of bounce, he's going to be able to lay that thing open like a spatula so that when he hits those super flops, that ball's going straight up and straight down. He's not having to worry about it digging through the turf. Now, again, we're talking about one of the greatest wedge players of all time, but you know, he's looking for something very specific, and it just so happens that Rahm really liked what Tiger was using and decided to bag it as well.
How many other tour pros end up hitting Rombo's wedge and say, "Hey, me too. I want that grind too."
Yeah, that honestly, I kind of wonder.
Got a craze out on tour.
I kind of wonder. It's, you know, I've always, it's funny. People wonder how much a player using a specific club, how much that influences other players on tour. It actually does a lot. You know, if a guy wins with a certain putter, I've talked to reps out on tour and they will say that they'll get at least, you know, three or four requests. Now, if it's a big name, sometimes it's even more requests than that. But guys pay attention to what's in the bag. So I would not be surprised if somebody realizes that Rahm is playing the TW grind and decides to throw one in their bag as well.
So be interesting to see if Tiger almost gets possessive over that grind, saying, "Hey, wait a minute.
Does he get any royalties for that?
This is for me. This is..." Right? So, you know, I believe that this was a grind that, you know, was pioneered by Mike Taylor. I know that Mike has taken care of Tiger's wedges and other clubs for Tiger for quite some time. And as you mentioned, the CNC milling process makes this something that, you know, as you mentioned with Mike, it sometimes would take him days to produce the grind to just be absolutely perfect. And it's one thing to produce one wedge with a really good grind, but to be able to replicate that grind product after product after product, that's where the real craftsmanship comes
that's
in.
That's why he's one of the best.
It's not just designing one piece. That's right. So being able to do it, rinse and repeat over and over and over on wedge after wedge, is kind of, you know, what separates the really, really great wedge makers, wedge designers, wedge builders from those that are second best, the ability to repeat it. So with the CNC milling, you know, this allows a wedge maker to basically prototype a grind and then to scan, you know, the way that grind, the geometry of that sole, and then they plug that into a CNC, you know, milling machine, and they're able to replicate that exactly. So it's really cool technology when you're talking about the efficiency required to be able to mass produce, you know, wedges with different grinds and things along those lines. So as far as, you know, what you mentioned for the lob wedge being set up to hit super flop shots, that's something that obviously, you know, makes sense for tour players. They need wedges that have very versatile designs that can hit it out of any condition. Unfortunately, when you start to use some heel relief and you get the effective bounce of the club down to, as you mentioned, 4 degrees, you're talking about something that for most players just is not anywhere near the type of bounce needed in order to hit good, successful, well-struck shots.
No, so not a chance. No, I
agree.
For
those that maybe... So for a lot of those players out there that are, you know, you hear about Tiger having a specific grind on his wedge, you want to find out more with the intention of potentially trying to get somebody to duplicate it or replicate it or whatever. I would advise that unless you're a highly skilled wedge player with great technique, you probably don't want to play Tiger's grind because it's probably not very easy to play some of these shots with that grind without having the proper technique. You also mentioned kind of the leading edge bevel, 34 degrees, you know. That's a leading edge that's fairly blunt, not very sharp, but then a club that has virtually no bounce when you open it up. Very unique design. I'd love to get my hands on one of those grinds to be able to take a look at it. But it goes back to, for me, the importance of getting the shaping just right on the sole of the club to be able to use a wedge effectively the way that you want to use it. And I don't think that amateur golfers understand the concept of sole width, bounce, and grind nearly well enough to make educated decisions when they're buying wedges. They tend to gravitate towards whatever is the most used out on tour or whatever their favorite tour player uses. But what they don't understand is that the specific brand and product they may be interested in may not offer a bounce and grind option that corresponds to the method that and the concept that that player is using around the greens. And you may have an affinity for a certain brand and a certain product, but making sure that it has a bounce and sole configuration that's conducive to performance is going to help your wedge game tremendously. So what I would advise the average amateur to do is do your research out there. Seek a PGA professional, seek a professional fitter, come into a TruSpec, and let us kind of look at what you're doing from your technique standpoint to be able to determine what the proper sole width, bounce, and grind is on your wedges. If you can get your wedges properly fit, it will have a tremendous impact over your scoring ability. So with that, I think we can get into Gear Spotlight for the week, and it's a perfect segue to get into Gear Spotlight, considering that we are highlighting wedges this week, and specifically the new Titleist Vokey product line, which will be launching after the first of the year. I know that last week the tour embargo lifted, so a lot of tour players started using the new product. I believe it's called SM8. Is that right, Jonathan?
That's right. Yeah, from one wedge to the next, and this is one that is going to be very popular. You know, Vokey as a whole has kind of a stranglehold on the market, and everybody knows the Vokey brand, and rightfully so. You know, Bob Vokey, and we talk about Mike Taylor. Bob Vokey's another one of those wedge geniuses, and you know, you just were talking there about lob wedges. If you ever want to get Voke fired up, ask him about what if players should have a lob wedge in the bag. You know, he's a big proponent of you know, amateur golfers using just the 56 and trying to manipulate it a little bit as opposed to throwing a lob wedge in there. But I digress. You know, so Vokey rolled out the new SM8. This is an every other year thing, and kind of interesting. They've typically used Vegas as the tour launch for SM8, but this year they pushed it all the way back to the last stop on the fall portion of the tour schedule. And I would dare say that it was wildly successful for Bob and his team. They had 37 players combined carrying 102 SM8 wedges the very first week out on tour. 102 SM8 wedges were actually 24 more than all of the wedges from the next closest brand, which is pretty incredible. Wow. When you consider that this wedge has only been out for a week and players really only had 3 days to test. And then Tyler Duncan goes along and wins the RSM with two Vokey SM8 wedges, a 5408 and a 5804. And I actually had a chance to talk to Tyler. And one of the things that he mentioned about these SM8 wedges was he just felt like he was able to flight them better. And this brings up something interesting, Tim, because, you know, Bob has really worked on trying to kind of add that flight and control with SM6 and SM7. And one of the ways that he did that was that visual CG with, you know, the lob wedge, and also with the, you know, closer to kind of around the pitching wedge in the lineup. You could see the mass in the head, and depending on that location, it was going to offer a different ball flight. Well, you know, I remember when Bob came out with SM6, and I asked him what he thought about kind of going away from that traditional shape and having that visual center of gravity on the outside, so that when golfers went to pick one up off the rack, they could see it. And, you know, he said he was on board with it, but he always kind of hinted at maybe they could find a way to conceal that visual CG. And I think, you know, after listening to Tyler Duncan tell me that he's able to flight it, I you know, also looking at SM8, it has a very traditional shape. And I think that's one of the reasons why it leads me to believe that Bob has found a way to conceal that visual CG from SM6 and SM7 and offer a more traditional shape. And again, the number of players that put it in the bag the first week, I think that goes to show you that a lot of guys are really digging the new look and also the performance.
Yeah, so the SM8 line, you know, I believe that was, I didn't get a chance to really work with it during club test because I was responsible for all the robotic stuff. But I believe that was part of the player testing that we conducted for Club Test 2020. You know, from what I understand about the product, it's got an amazing look to it, a very clean look, understated, not very busy, you know, looking at the back badging. I think some pictures have actually gotten out as well regarding just the overall aesthetic of SM8. You know, when you look at the spin milled lineup of wedges that's come out the last few years, the things that they've seemed to be focusing on is weight displacement and where the weight is centered, as you mentioned. They had some different mechanisms to displace weight and focus weight in certain areas, and those were visual when you looked at, you know, just externally looking at the club. Looking at SM8, it's a very, very clean, polished look. It's not very busy. It's pretty simple and understated. Now, as far as the design concept, you know, right now we're still underneath embargoes, and Titleist has been understandably, you know, fairly tight as far as, you know, letting all of us know what the technical differences of this product are. But I would be willing to bet you that they're taking that weight displacement another step forward. You know, when you start moving weighting around in a wedge, it can really start to affect the way that wedge performs. And as you mentioned, being able to flight a wedge lower, being able to have different feels on the face when you're utilizing different parts of the face. So, you know, the spin milled lineup from Vokey, from Titleist, you know, it's been an industry leader now for quite a few years. One of the things that I love the most when you're talking about the Vokey product line, and this plays into our comments we made just in our last segment, our last tour segment regarding the grind for Rombo's wedge, is the fact that Vokey wedges offer one of the largest catalogs of bounces and grinds available. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that SM8, for all of these different variations of bounces and grinds and lofts, I think that it's going to be available left-handed as well in all of the same bounces and grinds.
It better be. Awesome. It better be available in lefty.
Yeah, so there you go, Jonathan. You've got some wedges you can play now without getting shortchanged. So, you know, that's one of the things that I think is the tremendous benefit of the Vokey line, on top of the craftsmanship and the fact that you know you're getting a high-quality product whenever the Vokey name is attached to it. But the fact is that they've got such a wide catalog of products when you're talking bounce and grind options that you really can, depending upon who you are as a player, you can find pretty much anything in their wedge lineup that will fit you. And whether it's a different technique that you're using or whether you have different, you know, swing dynamics, whether you're steep or shallow or different turf textures. They've got something for everybody in their lineup. So,
they certainly do.
Looking forward to getting my hands on some SM8s and testing them out and seeing how they perform.
There might be some laying around the office, Tim. I can't tell you how many wedges they sent us for player testing when we were conducting that in Scottsdale.
How well was the new product received by them?
Very well received. And I'm not surprised. You know, I think when I looked at Vokey as a whole, based on player feedback, it was one of the most requested of the wedges that were hit. There were a couple surprises in there. I will say that, but yeah, I mean, Vokey seemed to be one of the big constants throughout player testing. And a lot of guys, you know, were just commenting on the feel of the wedge, which is something that Vokey's always prided himself on. So, yeah, a lot of positive feedback when it came to the new SM8. And, you know, we'll dive into that a little bit more in the club test issue for Golf Magazine. But yeah, a really positive response to Bob's new design.
And one last little piece on SM8. I was able to spend some time with some of the guys from Titleist last week, actually. And they shared a little tour feedback, which maybe you're usually in front of all this stuff, so I doubt that I can get a story in front of you here without you knowing about it. But one of the interesting tidbits is that every year when they bring out a new wedge line, Titleist will blind test their tour players on wedge A and wedge B, and they bring these tour players to an undisclosed location, and usually Bob Vokey's out there. And they won't let the tour players know that this is SM7 and this is SM8. As you know, a lot of times the differences cosmetically are very minimal.
Mm-hmm.
And so apparently they did a blind test with quite a few tour players, you know, a little bit ago, I'd go a couple months back, where they had wedge A and wedge B. And they had, you know, obviously a multitude of different lofts and grinds available for both wedge A and wedge B. And they blind tested these pros. I believe it was 8 different tour pros, and all 8 of them in a blind test. It's the only time that this has happened, but all 8 of those tour pros preferred what ended up being SM8 over the SM7 design.
It's pretty interesting.
So
I mean to have everybody picking the same wedge. Yeah, I would wonder what would happen if you ended up with a closer, you know, dead even split. What happens at that point?
Yep. Right? Do you shelve the product or go back to the drawing board? But needless to say, when it's unanimous, and as you know, tour players are some of the most finicky out there, and guarantee you that they may not know the technical differences, but they can probably feel and see some of them. But for 8 tour players to hands down say, we like the new one better than the old one, that's pretty rare. And obviously that's, you know, the tour usage report from this week is testament to the product, how many players have already put them in play. So it should be really exciting for customers out there to mess around with these SM8s once they do launch. And with that, I think it's perfect time to get into our mailbag segment for the week. Jonathan, we've gotten some great questions over the 20 weeks doing Fully Equipped. What do you have for us on this week's episode that we can help our listeners through?
Yeah, I mean, we always get some great questions, and we always appreciate you taking the time to ask these questions. And the first one we've got is from #Hagen on Instagram, who asks, in the last 5 years, what has changed most in today's drivers?
Well, I would probably say that club designers are spending more energy and more attention on helping the golfers out on off-center hits. Now, how are they doing that? Well, they're trying to increase MOI in the club heads. And the way that they're doing some of this is carbon fiber crowns, carbon fiber soles. And then that way they can, you know, one of your favorite flash words, discretionary weight. they can reallocate their discretionary weight into the chassis of the club or some other place where structurally it helps improve MOI. So I would say that falls under a bigger heading of making drivers more forgiving and making drivers more accurate. When you look at CT rules and limitations, and then before that COR rules and limitations, I think that a lot of driver designers will self-admittedly tell you that we're reaching the sound barrier as it pertains to speed. Because of the CT limits, hitting the ball out of the center of the face, the only thing that they're really focusing on to improve ball speed is not actually something to improve ball speed, but it's actually to improve clubhead speed. So when you start to look at some of the new products that have launched, when you look at some of the new products that will launch, as well as some of the products that have launched, like the Turbulator that you saw on some of the Ping G products, that's all addressing aerodynamics. So I think that driver designers are starting to realize that they've squeezed the last bit of juice out of the lemon when it comes to speed. And what they now need to focus on is when a player doesn't hit it in the center of the face, how can we develop a driver that doesn't have a significant speed drop off when you hit it on the toe or the heel or low or high? And B, how do we develop a driver that when you do hit it off the sides of the face doesn't end up wildly offline? So I think that's where we're seeing driver design over the last 5 years specifically start to pay some attention, is not so much trying to top out ball speed out of the middle of the face, but how do we generate more ball speed off the sides of the face, as well as when you look at twist face technology from TaylorMade, how do we redesign the concept of bulge and roll so that when a player doesn't hit it in the center of the face, they miss less fairways?
You're stealing my thunder, Tim.
Ultimately, I actually think that this is a great thing for driver design.
Yeah.
You know, driver designers have been chasing yardage for so many years. You could very easily argue that hitting it farther but still hitting it crooked isn't doing anybody any favors.
Yeah.
So now that we're starting to talk about driver designs where people will actually hit it straighter, I think that you'll start seeing some driver designs where the average player is really going to benefit from some of these new driver designs. If they're not going to lose a lot of speed and they're not going to hit it, if instead of hitting it 40 yards offline, now you only hit it 20 yards offline, that's going to be a huge benefit to the everyday player. To the tour player, they don't hit very many balls 40 yards offline to begin with. So are they going to benefit from these technologies? Probably not as much. But for the everyday dude, they're absolutely going to benefit from it. So
yeah.
That's what I would put my earmark on with driver design in the last 5 years. What would you say it's been?
No, and listen, I'm in agreement with you. That would probably be my 1A. And you know, I'll go a bit more contrarian and just, you know, you mentioned part of it, which was face design. You know, we've seen, you know, with TaylorMade, as you mentioned, the altering of the bulge and roll to try and mitigate those misses off the heel and the toe. But, you know, and you've also seen, you know, let's go back again to Cobra. You know, they're CNC milling the driver face now, which, you know, again, this isn't something that everybody's doing. Cobra's the only one who's doing it. But I just look at some of these manufacturers who are paying more attention to the face of this driver, not so much from a speed perspective, but changing the overall process to either make it more efficient and with tighter tolerances, or to make these drivers more accurate. And the other thing that I'd point out is just feel. I you know, if you go back to the feel and the sound of drivers, even, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, they were still, in my opinion, were on a little bit of on the louder side. And with you know, yeah, a lot of these manufacturers now using carbon composite in their driver designs, I mean, that was one of the things that really stuck out to me during player testing, Tim, was so many players were mentioning, and it wasn't just a couple of drivers, there were a lot of them that people were saying had a really pleasing sound. It wasn't on the louder side. It didn't sound tinny. It didn't sound like a howitzer, which is one of my favorite buzzwords when it comes to the sound of a driver. It just had a very pleasing sound to the ear. So yeah, you know, I do. I think those are two things. One with the driver face design, and then also with the overall sound and feel that I think that have really kind of been given priority during the design process.
Yep. So that leads us into mailbag question number 2 for the week. And this one was sent to us by Jay Pringled Golf on Instagram. Why are grip sizes and brands discussed so little? We never hear about what tour players are using when it comes to grips. Yeah, that's a great question.
Now,
what's the reason for this?
Well,
I've got a take on it. I'd be curious to get
yours. Yeah, I mean, okay, let me just point out that this isn't something that I've always done, but more recently we've been putting the grip that players are using. Because I know that when you see the winner's bag every week, people want to know what the player is using, not just their clubs, but also their grips. So we've been trying to make that a point. Also been doing it in the magazine for the big What's in the Bag spread, highlighting the grips that players are using. Why are grip sizes and brands discussed a little? I feel like for the most part, because people just think that a grip is a grip is a grip. And that's partly why we just haven't heard a lot about it, is because people just aren't that excited about grip technology, when in actuality, I would say that grip technology has changed. You know, there are new rubber materials that are being used to change the overall feedback that you're getting when you're hitting the golf ball. You know, actually some of these manufacturers, Golf Pride in particular, they've been using some of their molds that some of their big name tour players actually use, and bringing those grip molds out to the masses now in some of their more popular designs. So it happens. I feel like, again, it's a golf grip, and people just don't get as excited as they do about a guy using a new driver or a new putter. I mean, where do you kind of stand on this, Tim?
It's very tough to see grip technology. I mean, when I'm showing somebody a shaft and you can see the layering of pre-preg, and then you can feel such a drastic difference, you know, throughout your swing, it's easy, you know, to buy in that there's a difference in technology when you're talking about a shaft. When you're talking about a club head, it's very easy to see the technology. Most brands are finding ways to highlight the technology cosmetically, you know, to help them with differentiating their products. When you're talking about a grip, it's very difficult to see any sort of technology. When you talk about like fingerprint technology, which is like a micro etching, which Lamkin engages in. When you're talking about, you know, some of the multi-material technologies that Golf Pride worked with in developing the new Decade grip, it's tough. Yes, you can see it, but it's not like it's this really standout technology piece like a movable weighting piece is on a driver, or like a slot is on an iron. So I think it's tough for a consumer to buy in when there's not tangible technology that they can touch and feel that makes sense.
Except for like part of it. Another Arcos, I would not to interrupt you, Tim, but I would say, you know, Arcos has has partnered with Golf Pride and also with Lamkin, and their little GPS sensor that they have in the butt end of these grips. You know, the initial version, I will say, was cumbersome. I could not get comfortable with jamming a plug in the butt end of the grip of my irons.
And it disrupted swing weight.
Yeah, it did.
The initial
it did.
Plugs that Arcos used,
you're right,
disrupted swing weight.
Yep.
And then you had the issue of if the plug, you know, somehow became detached. Now, they actually invented... and Cobra actually invented this, and then they licensed this technology out, even to some of their, that's right. So Cobra owns a patent on an embedded sensor in a grip. And that's basically what Arcos is using for their platform. And then they license that out to all the other folks that are using a sensor embedded grip. You know, it's interesting. I was earlier in the year, 8 a.m. companies, which is the parent company of my company, TrueSpec, as well as your company, Golf.com. Yeah, so 8 a.m. was involved in some discussions with Arcos about potentially forming some alliances, partnerships, maybe even some investment there. It was a relationship that ultimately 8 a.m. companies didn't pursue, but so I was able to have a lot of lengthy conversations with the folks over at Arcos, and first and foremost, their product is really cool and has the potential to really disrupt the industry with the data that it can provide. But, you know, it's a grip embedded sensor, basically. So that kind of opens up Pandora's box for actually putting some tech into grips that makes a lot of sense. Jamie Ledford is the CEO of Golf Pride, and he and I have had multiple conversations. We're fortunate enough at TrueSpec to operate a facility in Pinehurst. So whenever I'm in the Pinehurst area visiting our location there, I always try to get over to the Pinehurst Golf Pride facility. That's where their company is headquartered. And they just opened up a brand new headquarters there this year, actually. And it's pretty amazing. I can't wait. I'm actually supposed to be there next weekend. So Hopefully JB and I will get some time to sync up. But imagine if you had a grip that was able to tell you, you've seen like pressure, what do they call them now? Force plates. You see pressure patterns on as far as the feet for a player. Imagine if you could actually look at a pressure pattern on a grip, where you could see exactly where in the fingers somebody was holding it tightly and how that was changing during the golf swing. That's really cool technology, which I know will be coming out of grip manufacturers at some point. Whether it's for a production line item or for a training aid, I'm not sure. But going back into why grips are so rarely discussed, the perception that there's not a lot of technology in there, number one, I think is part of it. I actually think it would be well worth discussing some concepts as far as grips. If you take a grip that is foreign to a world-class player, like Rosie plays the Lampkin 3 Gens, and specifically there was a... he plays the RELs, excuse me. And we updated grips one year going from one grip to the next, and it was supposed to be identical. It turned out that the grips were 1 gram apart. The 2016 version was 1 gram lighter than the 2017 version. And we were building up a set of clubs with the new version of the grip, and lo and behold, he could feel it. And he said, you know, these grips are different. The swing weights are lighter. And so if you have a heavier grip, that's going to make the swing weight just a hair lighter if all other things are equal. And sure as heck, he could feel it. So for tour players, if they play a grip that's unfamiliar to them, with a vast majority of them, it will definitely throw them for a loop. And whether it's placebo effect or whether it's an actual performance effect, most of them will not perform as well if they're playing with a grip that isn't comfortable and reliable for them. So maybe it is something we need to discuss. Maybe I can get Jamie on the pod to discuss what they're doing over at Lampkin, what they're doing over at Golf Pride.
Or just what the future of grips looks like, you know, as you're just mentioning,
yeah.
there's a lot there. I mean, yes, grip technology, it's tough to see, but I do feel like if you're looking at a part of the golf club that has a lot of potential for growth, I really think that the golf grip of all things is an area where you could see a lot of growth here in the next, 5 to 10 years.
And you're going to start seeing, different materials will allow grip designers to design products that are ultra lightweight or in some cases ultra heavy. You know, if you go to I believe it was a 19 gram grip once, which is feather light, that's going to help out a builder achieve swing weighting. So, and then when you look at putter grips, obviously this is something that has captured a lot of attention. Both for, the regular golfer, and we've discussed it a good bit on Fully Equipped. Putter grips, with the emergence of Superstroke, Rosemark, Garson grips, you're starting to see a lot of these putting grip manufacturers come out with really innovative designs and concepts that have a huge impact over the way that people actually make putting strokes. So I think that the grip designers are, focusing a little bit of their attention onto putter grips because they know that that's something tangible that people can see. It's definitely worth diving a little bit deeper as far as talking about gear when you're talking about, technology and how it's impacting performance. Because if you pick up an old Golf Pride Victory from, circa 1992, it doesn't feel very good relative to the grips that we put on our clubs these days. So they've definitely made some significant improvements, not just to the overall texture, but also durability. So, that's a topic definitely worth getting into. And with that, perfect opportunity to get into part two of our David Orr interview. As mentioned last week, David Orr operates the Flatstick Academy out of the Pine Needles Lodge in Pinehurst, North Carolina. One of the world's best putting coaches, putting researcher, putter fitter. Very proud to have him on the pod. And with that, here's part two. That's perfect segue into the next part, what I want to get into here, which is putter grips.
Okay, yeah, cool.
So putter grips, the shaping of the grip.
Yes.
You know, we look at a Rosemark grip, and that kind of fits into the way that the hand's designed.
Brilliant, right?
And then you look at, just put your hands on a super stroke and go with a long thumb,
yeah,
and then pull that thumb back and put your finger down the shaft, your index finger, and see where your hand is actually contacting the grip.
Well, you can also see that the deviation of my wrist
changes. So your ulnar deviation, when your hands are in more of that ulnar deviated position, that's going to cut down in how much twisting you get in the putter face.
It really who's the Eric Kaplan? He wrote the four secret locks. I agree with his four principles, but I don't think they have to be that extreme.
Right.
So you don't have to go end range ulnar deviation, right. But you should go to where it seals the wrist there. We call it pistols pointing slightly down.
Right.
And, a pistol style hand requires a pistol grip. And, you know, we're talking about the four things. We got grip shape, grip size, grip texture.
Yep.
And we got grip weight, which is the thing that ruins that feel of that putter when you change it.
Yeah, it gets really heavy. Yeah. You're putting with a head that may not be all that heavy. Now all of a sudden you've got a very light swing weight. You have no sense of where the club face is during the stroke. A lot of problems there. But the thing that you and I have had multiple conversations throughout the last few years is the shaping of the grip.
Yeah.
And the way that the shape of the grip kind of fits into a player's hands. The width of the palm, the length of the fingers. All of these things play into what grip
because
is really
affecting,
best.
Here's what it is. So here's the truth behind it. So you sit there and go, well, sure, a grip shouldn't matter. Well, it's the grip and how it affects how your hands and fingers go on the club, but more importantly, how your wrists move.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So when we're fitting a grip, the fingers and the hand and the wrist and forearm, it's affecting all the stuff, all the magic happens in the hands. So to me,
I don't want to putt using my hands.
Yeah, everybody uses their hand. You're holding on to it. Even if you putted with your shoulders, all the energy and force would come down your arms and into your hands and into your fingers. So what's very important about grip fitting, it's not that the grip is going to fix your stroke, but the grip is going to change the way your hands and fingers are on the club, affecting your wrist, affecting your forearm. We saw it with Brian Mogg out here.
Yep.
I changed his thumb and forefinger, and I changed his wrist. And all of a sudden he goes, oh, my goodness, the club's tracking in plane now instead of swiping across it.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm a big guy. I kind of start with the putter first, ball. And what's the ball doing? What's the putter doing?
Right.
And then I go into the fingers, and I go into the hands, and I go into the wrist, and then the forearm, the elbow. And I work my way from the putter up to the shoulders and saying, okay, how do these shoulders need to move relative to that movement? But I'm working my way back, and what's funny is – I remember speaking at Open Forum a couple years ago and Stan Utley sitting down there, Brad Faxon sitting down there, and I just basically said, I have yet to see a pure shoulder stroke. Everybody that's any good putts with their hands and arms in a blend of their
shoulders. What reaction did that get?
Yeah. Oh, they loved me. Matter of fact, Stan stood up and said, I need to come up and talk to you.
Yep.
Yeah, and he's a great guy, right? Brad's a fantastic guy. So I don't care what people say. I'm looking at actual data.
Yeah.
I have yet to see.
And that's one point I want to make here. You don't believe something just because somebody else that's an expert in the industry tells you something.
No, I measure it.
You have to get on your 3D system. Yeah. You're going to be a skeptic until the data proves it right.
Yeah, so Doc Neal, Dr. Rob Neal, Phil Kenyon, myself, we all work together. We collect data. They send me the hard data, the measurements. And then I sort it in Excel spreadsheets, and then I go back to the animation, and I look at the numbers myself.
Right.
And, you know, we might be talking a degree, but, I mean, if you're doing a little bit of a degree de-lofting with the wrist and a little bit of changing the lie.
A degree might as well be multiple miles in putting.
Well, a degree in the wrist one way and a degree another way and a twist in the forearm, next thing you know, the putter's 2 degrees closed.
Right.
It doesn't take much.
No.
And then to undo that, like what we saw with Cordy, he was under-twisting it shut.
Yep.
De-lofted, under-twisted shut, and then he's jamming his right arm down the line. These balls are going left of left.
Yeah, and using a putter that's designed to go left.
Exactly.
So, talk to our listeners out there that choose their putter based upon their favorite tour player using a certain putter.
I wouldn't do that.
Bad idea.
I did that.
I did too.
Let's be honest. I did that too. And, you know, hey. Let's talk about
Didn't work out so well because we're sitting here right now.
Let's talk about it. Let's be honest. Didn't work out too good. We're sitting here. But, you know, I had the Ping Answer, and then when the Ping Answer 2 came out in stainless steel with a line on it, I had to have that.
Yep.
And then when the Answer 3 came out and it came out in beryllium copper, the Answer 2 came out, I had to have that. And then I had a Ping Zing.
Yep.
And then I had a Ping Zing 2. Then I had a Ping Zing Melanite, the black one. Remember that?
Yep.
And then I had the PAL 2 and the PAL 4, and Jeff Maggart had a I remember at Ben Hogan Tour event I was playing, and he had a Ping Pal 4 Brilliant Copper. I said, I got to have that. And you know, so I went through the whole Ping family, and then by the time Scotty Cameron came around, holy
yeah,
cow.
Yeah, you were cooked at that point.
I was cooked.
So,
yeah.
Then now, how about our listeners out there that choose a putter based upon looks good, feels good, made a couple in a store?
Yeah, they're results-oriented people. They're not process-oriented.
Yeah, and the, and what's that? How long is that putter going to stay in the bag?
Maybe the front nine.
So, fitting a putter, you know, it's so crucially important. Obviously, when we're talking putters, placebo effect definitely can take hold. Some preferences.
People look at results instead of how it's affecting their ecosystem or their process. I'm not a Patriots fan, but, I mean, Bill Belichick says it best. You know, do your job.
Do your job.
Stick to your
process. Know what your job is and then do it.
Yeah, know what your job is and do it. So when you're dealing with putting, you need to be educated when you go into a store. What kind of head design am I looking for? Do I tend to pull putts or push them?
Yep.
Okay, that should be the first question you ask yourself. You're sitting there at the PGA Superstore. You got these hundreds of putters. You don't know which one to pick.
Yep.
All right? You should say, do I push or pull? Oh, I tend to push.
Right.
Well, then you walk away from all those high MOI mallets and go over to, let's just start with a square back.
Yep.
Start with a square back and then go into maybe a blade, or maybe a hatchback, and see if there's a difference where the ball's starting.
Yep.
All right? And then the next thing we need to look at is, okay, what length putter do I need? This is my Joseph A. Bank fit. Okay, so I measure a person wrist to floor as a starting point. So let's just say you measure 34 inches.
Yep.
Right? But you like to putt from a crouched posture. So I go, okay.
Minus one.
Minus 1 inch. Let's go to 33 or 33 and a half.
Yep.
Okay, or that measurement's 34 inches on your wrist, but you tend to putt with a little bit more upright posture and you like your elbows bent like Ricky. Then we go plus one.
Yep.
So it's just a starting point. So if you know where you tend to start the pull or push, and then if you're having maybe speed issues, you may or may not be a candidate for grooves.
Yep. So if you go with grooves, the ball's going to come off a little bit more dead.
A little softer.
A little softer. The ball speeds. Another thing which I've noticed, larger size grips. The ball comes off softer with a larger or more oversized grip. So you use a Super Stroke 3.0, 4.0, 5.0. You're already a player that's struggling to come up short.
Yeah.
This may exacerbate that short tendency. So knowing what your tendencies are and how they're matching up with certain equipment, don't just throw – that's getting back into the grip discussion. I love the players out there that go out and change their grip on their putter. And
it ruins the feel of it.
And they don't even understand that they just ruined their putter.
Yeah, because they just went from a – let's just say they went from a – 59 gram grip to 120 gram grip. This happened with a European tour player I just worked with in Paris.
So it's not just the high handicappers.
No, it's the tour players too. And matter of fact, what's funny is I hate to tell people out, you know how like fashion in Europe is always ahead of the US a little
right.
bit, right? I hate to tell people, but big grips kind of went out like a year or two ago. I mean, they're not in vogue.
Yeah.
However, you know what vogue is?
Mid-size
grips.
Yeah. Mid-size grips are becoming a lot more.
Absolutely.
Because you're getting some of the stability that you would like to get out of the bigger size grip.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's getting a little bit of weight to counteract these super heavy heads because it's so hard to get around that with design these days. But it's not these really large grips. As you know.
Hey, I tell you what. Go ahead.
Larger size grips, does it reduce hand motion?
Not in plane, but around the shaft. It reduced the twisting.
Yep.
But it did not cure what it says it did, which was wristiness.
Right.
Matter of fact, if anything, it makes it worse.
Yep.
And what's interesting.
In the plane.
Yeah, in the plane. And I'm going to tell you something really cool. So I worked for Justin Rose for 5 years, and we were back at Congressional playing with KJ Choi in a practice round. KJ Choi had the first adopter. The first oversized grip.
And it was really big, too, if I remember right.
Really big. And I remember asking KJ, and, you know, he barely speaks English, but he knew I wanted to, like, putt with the putter, and I put this thing in my hand. It's huge, and my hands felt so far apart from each other.
Yep.
And I hit the putt, and I couldn't even feel the club head, and there was a vibration that came in. Now, I'm not knocking any brand.
Right.
Matter of fact, Superstroke is intelligent. They've come from ready. They've gone from these big grips to from, you know, 3.0 to 2.0 to 1.0, then even pistols, GT Tours. So it's not a brand thing. It's a size and shape thing.
Right.
And a texture thing and a weight.
Right.
You know, so it's interesting that, you know, some of the best putters of all time actually had the smallest grips, and they were made out of rubber or leather.
Yep. You know? Yeah, and we see this all the time with really good putters, that they're using a lot more conventional designs. They're not using some of these huge MOI mallet heads. Yeah. They're using grips and grip shapes and types and sizes that are more traditional.
Yeah, so artists don't need sledgehammers or big push brooms to paint, you know, paintings on it. You know, I just recently went to the Louvre. There's no way they're using a push broom as a paintbrush. You know what I mean? So, but sizes for somebody. I mean, there's, like I said, I fit somebody the other day with a high MOI because they lacked coordination. I gave them a high MOI head. I gave them a super stroke, you know, the large oversized grip. And I just knew that this gave this guy some sense of stability.
Right.
I knew he was never going to be a Faxon or a Tiger Woods. So big grips are for somebody, but they're not for everybody. And what drives me nuts is...
And to arbitrarily switch to it.
Yeah. So it drives me nuts to see people holding the club in the base of their fingers with a pistol-style hand.
Yeah, it doesn't make
sense. And they got
a
super stroke flat sew 2.0, and I'm just sitting there going, you want
to
know...
Your concept is so disconnected from your gear.
Yeah.
And they're not aware of it. Unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation out there, which creates opportunities for guys like you and I that actually drill down on this stuff and would like to think that we test this stuff and understand it at a deeper level.
Well, two major grip OEMs have contacted me in the last 2 weeks. Want to hear what I have to say about it? Because obviously I'm poking the gorilla a little bit, you know. But I'm not saying everybody should have a small grip. But the trend in fitting that you're seeing and I'm seeing is a lot of midsize, maybe a little bit between a small and
a lot
and
of arm lock lately.
Yeah.
A lot of folks have gone down the arm lock route, which is infinitely difficult to fit.
That's another show.
Yeah, that's a whole podcast that we can do on arm lock.
But yeah, so does the putter matter? I mean, yeah, the putter matters to a lot of players. It can matter to – I mean, it could be the thing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It could be the magic bullet that cures it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think in some cases, it's a lot more instructionally based. I mean, it's different from player to player. You know, something I'd want to get to here is keeping an open mind with your putter fitting.
Yeah, and here's the thing, too. Here's where the industry is right now. So we talked about five basic putter fitting philosophies. I might fit somebody to a certain thing because I have preferences, right?
Right.
But if they went and got fit by somebody else, they'll say, whoa, no, that fitting was terrible.
Right.
You need to have this. But what's interesting is the five basic fitting philosophies, which is fitting for aim, fitting for face at impact, fitting for face to path.
Face to path, fitting for arc.
Arc and rotation, and then
fitting
ball roll.
So
those are the basic five. You know, so if you went and got fit for ball roll, they're trying to give you an even roll and – you know, with grooves and 2 degrees aloft and see how it's rolling and measure it on Quintic, but yet you can't get the face squared up.
Yeah. So the two that we really focus on at TruSpec, as you know, and we've worked together on this, is face at impact and ball roll, those two in conjunction. The idea being that if you can start online and roll it at a consistent speed with the proper type of roll dynamics coming off the face, you stand to make some putts if you can start it online with good roll. There are obviously other ways to do it, but keeping an open mind about the tool that you're using, you know, is something that I can't express. It's so important. You know, you see so many biases when somebody comes in, especially with putters. You see so many biases. Sometimes those biases can overrule what works on a functional level, but I think for the average golfer out there, to keep an open mind is so important. I know that you see this. You know, in closing, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, obviously you've done some work here with us with TruSpec in the toolbox.
I love the toolbox.
So by toolbox, the matrix of putters.
Yeah.
We use a Club Connects putter system that allows us to interchange different shafts. We're not doing it to test shafts. We're doing it because we want to test different lengths of shafts. And plus, we want to be able to test different grips.
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe I want to use a Lampkin deep etched at 33 inches. Well, wait a minute. I really like this head design, but maybe I want to tweak it a little bit and go to 34 inches using the same grip.
We can do that.
So we can have a matrix of, you know, 40 different shafts, which are comprised of 4 different grips at multiple different lengths or 10 different grips at multiple different lengths, and be able to mix and match that with, we have 40 heads in our matrix.
Yeah, and that's the cool thing I was just getting ready to say is these are putters that people can actually buy.
Right.
You know, on the market. You know what I mean? and they get fit, and you know, they can get it custom a little bit. So instead of it, the lie being 70 can be bumped up to 71, or the loft being 3 we can knock it to 2.5
right,
and put that Lampkin deep etch grip on it
at a 33 inch length,
exactly, or yeah. 33 and a quarter, 33 and a half, whatever right. you want. So it becomes a custom OEM
right
putter, as opposed to just an OEM putter.
Yeah, 33 inches, bag it and send it out the door.
Exactly.
You know, so, and then the other idea here being is that you and I work very hard to have a matrix that touches all the bases, so to speak, where we're playing around with multiple different offsets, multiple different head shapes, multiple different face textures, multiple different alignment packages, multiple different toe hangs. You won't see two putters in the 40 that are the same.
No, there's always a reason why that one's in the matrix.
Right, there's always a reason behind it. They may look, to the layperson out there, may look the same, but they have the same alignment package, they have the same neck, they have the same head shape, but this one has grooves and this one doesn't.
Well, look at the two Bettinardis that we got in there. We got the BB1 with like an inch and a quarter offset,
right.
inch and a half offset, yep. and it's got a longer neck.
Yep.
And then you've got...
It sits a little more face balanced.
Yeah, and then we've got one in there that's got a little shorter neck.
Yeah, going to sit more 45 degrees.
Yeah, still a little more plumber's neck, but it's got a softer face.
Yep. So it may look identical, but there are little nuances that... And so the ability to have all these variations when you go through a fitting, and it's going to help a club fitter. It gives them more knobs to turn, so to speak, yeah.
and,
to where, you know, we can dial it
and
in.
To me, if I were an OEM, there's no doubt I'd want to have my product in that matrix if yeah. they want to sell putters. Yeah. And that's what they're in the business of doing, is selling putters. So you'd want, if I were an OEM, I'd want to make sure I've got my finest in that matrix.
And I know that you and I have had this discussion many times about how much fun you're having with this toolbox.
Yeah, because I can do my job.
Yeah,
I got a toolbox to do the job. I mean, I've been there before. There was a period where I stopped fitting for Adele when I was teaching on tour, and I didn't have a fitting system, and I felt naked.
Yeah.
I felt like a carpenter without a hammer. You know what I mean?
And, I love your analogies,
and a
man.
Belt, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and you know, so when you can have a toolbox, especially one that's as good as TruSpec, and it's brand agnostic. I'm not sitting there trying to sell you
yeah,
a putter. Brand. And the price point in there is beautiful, too. We didn't even talk about that. I mean, you got price point where people can afford a putter.
Yep.
Custom. Versus putters right on up there where you're going to drop, you know, have to get the black card or the metal one out to buy it. But, you know, that's the cool thing in the matrix a lot of people don't realize is, yeah, I got that same head in a cheaper price point
yep.
here.
Yep.
You know, remember we had the Toulons in there and the Odysseys, and that's the same company people yeah. don't realize. It's just Toulon's the higher end. And say, okay, well, you can't afford the Toulon, but hey, all right, so you wanted the Toulon Austin with the flow neck. They don't make that anymore, and it's a little pricey. It would be cost you a lot to get it custom. Look at this Odyssey number 3.
Yep. You know, so in closing, David, for all our listeners out there, what advice would you give to them when it comes to choosing their putter?
Be wise. Be smart. Listen to these podcasts. Be educated. Don't be sold a bill of goods, because otherwise you're just going to keep buying putter after putter after putter. And here's the sad thing about it. If we're really good at fitting, it should be their last putter.
Right.
But at least when you get fit.
It's not like their club head speed is going to go up and they need to change shafts.
Exactly. But go in with the next putter saying, hey, I got fit for this head and this hosel and this offset. It might be a different brand. It might be, instead of silver, it might be, or stainless, it might be black.
Right.
But get the same specs and same design. Be smarter with your purchases is what I'm saying.
Dior, this has been awesome, man. Can't thank you enough for being on Fully Equipped, the most demanded person we've had on Fully
Hopefully,
Equipped.
Hopefully it didn't disappoint.
Yeah, so look forward to having you on again. And for all those folks out there that are looking to find out a little bit more about David Orr and Flatstick, how are they going
to
find you?
Just go to my website, www.flatstickacademy.com. Email me at orgolf@gmail.com, and feel free to call me. I'm old school. Just call me and I'll actually answer. If it goes to my voicemail, I'll actually call you back. So, yeah, I'm old school. I don't like texting. I don't like emails. Call me.
Awesome, man. Thanks so much.
Tim. Thanks.
And that'll do it for episode 20 of Fully Equipped. We can't thank David Orr enough for his time and his insight. It's just a whole lot of fun listening to him talk about putters. We're going to be doing things a little bit differently next week, moving up the release of Fully Equipped to Tuesday, and there's a reason for that. We have a big name guest who's going to be hopping on the podcast to talk about putters as well. So make sure you check it out when it comes out on Tuesday. And if you want to keep following us for more gear content, make sure you follow Tim on Twitter and Instagram. He's @ Club Whisper on Twitter. and at Tim_Breon78 on Instagram. I'm at Jonathan R. Wall on Twitter and Instagram. And with that, we look forward to seeing you next week.